Hey, good morning. My name is Jeremiah. I'm one of the pastors here at Westbridge, and it's awesome to have you here. Thanks for joining us. I want to say hello to those of you in our parent viewing area as well. Thanks for joining us there. That's a great option if you have small children that you prefer to keep with you during the service. And today we're wrapping up a series that we've been in for the last several weeks called What Makes You Happy? And throughout this series, to invite people back to this series the first week, we handed out a smiley face stress ball. And when we did that, we actually got some pictures, and someone sent us some pictures, and we started doing a kind of a hashtag Westbridge happy face social media competition of pictures. And so we've kind of been showing you some of those each week, and today we want to show you the four finalists. These are the winners of our sort of impromptu competition. The first one is, this is the picture that first got sent back to me that got it all started, and that's this one right here. This got sent to us, and so we had to include it and said, man, let's do a competition out of this. And then the second one is just too cute not to make the cut. That's just adorable, right? And then the third one is just one of our faves. This was a couple of smiley faces off-roading, which is pretty cool. And then, of course, top points for creativity right here. This is great. Man, we had a lot of fun with this. Each of those people that submitted those four, we're sending some coffee cards to this week. And also, we actually have one more. Many of you may be aware that Eli Berkman, who's our director of home churches on our staff here, him and his wife have been expecting a child, and they had their baby this morning. This is Everly Joy right here with the smiley face. And so, yeah, super awesome. So I told him that it was no problem, that he could be here by second service, and it should be fine. So over the last several weeks, we've been talking about what makes you happy. And as we've talked about this, I have to be honest, there's been some things that I've learned. There's been some things that as we've kind of explored this topic together about what makes you happy and the things that surround happiness, I've really been able to pull away some practical things that have been wisdom for me in this series, and I hope that you've had some things that you've learned that you can apply to your life as well. And I want you to know, if you missed any of the weeks, you can go back and check them out on our website anytime. So if you're kind of coming in, this is week six, our final week of this series, and if you're kind of coming in, joining us at the end of the movie, here's kind of where we've been. The very first week, we said that happiness is a lot more about who than what. That your life, really, your happiness is a lot about relationship, a lot less than it's a lot more about relationship than it is about material things. That if you have some who's in your life, those are way more important than the what's in your life. And then the second week, we talked about the fact that peace with God actually paves the way to make peace with yourself, and it equips you to make peace with others. When you know that God's forgiven you, you learn to forgive yourself. And when you know that God's forgiven others, you learn to forgive others. And then the third week, we said happiness is not immediately accessible. It's something that you sow and reap your way toward. And so happiness isn't something that you can just immediately grab onto. It's an outcome. It's a result of decisions that you make. And then week four, we talked about how happy people find a way to give their life away in service to others. And then last week, we said happy people avoid regret by listening to the voice of wisdom. And so throughout this series, as we've talked about sowing and reaping, as we've talked about listening to the voice of wisdom, you have to make decisions to sort of sow in the right direction. And you are building your future with the choices that you're making today. And the problem is that as you begin to plant seeds in your life, oftentimes you don't know what direction your life is heading in. And you could be sowing in the wrong direction. And that's why you could be sowing in the direction of your own unhappiness and not realize it, because it's not an immediate thing. You make decisions in your 20s that maybe lead you somewhere in your 30s or your 40s, and all of a sudden you go, I'm now in my 30s and I'm unhappy. But really, it didn't happen suddenly. You were making decisions throughout your teen years or your 20s that led you to where you are. And the temptation then, when we arrive at this place and we go, oh, I'm unhappy, the temptation is to blame our spouse, to blame our kids, blame our career, blame the school district, blame the government. And the reality is that you built your future with the decisions that you made. Now, that's the bad news. The good news, however, is that you can control what you are sowing into your future starting today. You can control what your life looks like 10 years from now, starting today. What your life looks like next year, 5 years from now, 20 years from now, starting today. And there is no area where this principle applies more and is felt more tangibly than in the area of our money and finances. This is where we feel this the most. Now, here's the deal. We all know that there is a connection between our money and our happiness. We know that that's true. Whenever you hear a speaker or a pastor, you know, someone like me who gets up and says, you know, money won't make you happy, money won't make you happy, money won't make you happy, somewhere inside of yourself, you kind of go, okay, I guess that's true. But the reality is none of us believe that, right? You don't believe that. I don't believe that. I don't care how many times you hear money won't make you happy. You always think, well, you know, try me. Where do I sign up to find out if money will make you happy? Like, I want to be a part of that test group, right? Where do I sign up for that? Because at the end of the day, we all think money might make me happy. We all think that. And someone said this to me last week. Money won't make you happy, but you've never seen anyone on the back of a jet ski not smiling. Like, oh, that's a great point. That's because there actually is a connection between happiness and money. There is a connection. And even if you're not a religious person, even if you're not a church person, you're not a Jesus person, you know, you're just dating us right now, you're kind of just exploring things. If you would just for a moment, for the next few minutes, forget that you're in church, forget that I'm a pastor, if you could just hear these words, and if you could just grasp this idea, this is so extremely helpful. There is a connection between money and happiness. But here's where most of us get this wrong. When it comes to money, most of us believe it's about more. See, that's the connection for us. Okay, the connection between my money and my happiness is more. In other words, if I had more money, then I would be more happy. That's what we think. If I had more money, then I'd be more happy. So let me ask you a couple of questions, and this is a keep your elbow to yourselfer. How much more money would it take to make you more happy? How much more money would it take to make you more happy? We've said this throughout this series, that happy people are those who are at peace. And so let me ask this question another way. How much more money would it take for you to be at peace? What's that number? What would it take? And the answer is the same for every single one of us. More than I currently have. That's the answer, right? If I had more than I currently, I don't know what that number is. I can't quantify that for you, but I know it's more than what I have today. If I had more than I have now, then I would be more happy. Then I would have peace. And yet, here's what we all know to be true. You know people with a whole lot more money than you who aren't happy. You know people with a much bigger house and much fancier cars and a bigger, you know, bank account, and they go on way more vacations and they're not happy. You know those people. And you also know people who have way less than you, who seem to just be happy. And it seems like their whole family just loves each other and they get along and they don't have a lot, but they just are happy. And so we know that the connection between money and happiness couldn't possibly simply be more. As a matter of fact, King Solomon wrote this thousands of years ago. He said, "Those who love money will never have enough. How meaningless to think that wealth brings true happiness. The more you have, the more people come to help you spend it. So what good is wealth, except perhaps to watch it slip through your fingers? People who work hard sleep well, whether they eat little or much. But the rich seldom get a good night's sleep. There's another serious problem I've seen under the sun. Hoarding riches harms the saver. Money's put into risky investments that turn sour. Everything is lost. In the end, there is nothing left to pass on to one's children. We all come to the end of our lives as naked and empty-handed as the day we were born. We can't take our riches with us." Solomon says, you have never seen a hearse pulling a U-Haul behind it. As a matter of fact, let me ask you this. Who would you say is more satisfied? The person who has 4 children or the person who has $1 million? See, I'd say the person with 4 children, because they don't want any more. Isn't this amazing? Solomon writes this, and he writes this a few thousand years ago. What that shows us is this. This is not a 21st century Western culture American issue. This is a human being issue. This is a human heart issue. This has affected us as a species for thousands and thousands of years. We have not been able to figure out that the connection between my money and my happiness isn't more. As a matter of fact, here's what Jesus taught the connection is between happiness and money. Jesus said when it comes to money, the key is management. It's management. It's not about how much you have. It's about how you manage what you have that determines whether or not you will be happy when it comes to your money. It's not about more. It's about management. In other words, money actually can contribute to your happiness if you manage it well. Remember, anything that undermines your peace undermines your happiness. We've said this throughout the series. If it undermines your peace, then it undermines your happiness. That means if you mismanage your money, then you undermine your peace, regardless of how much you have or how much you make. If you mismanage it, it undermines your peace, which undermines your happiness. And this is where many Americans find themselves today in our culture. If you don't manage your money will manage you. Your money will be the one in charge. It becomes the boss in that relationship. And if your finances are managing you, then you don't have peace because you feel out of control. And when you feel out of control, there's anxiety. And when you feel anxiety, it's hard to be happy. And that's why the words of Jesus that we're going to read carry so much weight and are so practical and relevant for us for today. Because Jesus writes this. He says, "No one can serve two masters. For you will hate one and love the other. You will be devoted to one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and be enslaved to money." Now, you would think that when Jesus is drawing this contrast, he would say that the opposite of God is, you know, you cannot serve God and the devil, right? Or you cannot serve God and sin, or you cannot serve God and be devoted to evil. But he says, no, the opposite of God in this context of devotion is your money. You will either serve God or you will be enslaved to your pursuit for money and possessions. In Jesus' way of thinking, the chief competitor for your devotion and the chief competitor for my devotion is our desire for money and possessions. And he says, God wants your devotion. That means God wants to be the one calling the shots in your life, but there is something else that wants to call the shots in your life. Your desire, my desire for stuff. And Jesus says you cannot serve two masters. You will be devoted to one or the other. Now, what does that mean, devoted to? Devoted to means I've got my eye on. Devoted to means this is the filter through which I make decisions. Devoted to means this is what I'm driving towards. This is what I'm moving towards in my life. Here's a great way to think about what you're devoted to. Let me ask you this question. Has your desire for something ever caused you to do something stupid? Now, I want to be clear. I'm saying something stupid. There's not a comma there. I'm not calling you stupid. It's not something stupid. I'm saying, has your desire for something ever caused you to do something that you regret? And I think the answer for all of us is yes. My desire for something has caused me to do something that I wish I hadn't. Now think about that. That's a desire for, that leads to, that equates to a devotion to. I want something, so I'm going to align my life to acquire that thing. You were devoted to acquiring the thing that you wanted. You were devoted to your desire to spend in order to satisfy some appetite that will never be satisfied by simply getting more. And this is where it starts for us. Jesus says, in that process, you actually become enslaved to your desire for more. It becomes the boss. It becomes your master. You become enslaved to this desire, and you cannot be equally devoted to God and enslaved to your devotion to acquiring. It just doesn't work. And here's where this starts for us. I want to give you three words that are words that are associated with money. The first one is this: discontentment. Discontentment. This is where it starts for us. Discontentment is a powerful thing. Discontentment ensures that I'm never satisfied with what I have because I am so aware of all that you have, and I'm very aware of all that there is to have. As a matter of fact, awareness is what drives our discontentment. Awareness is a powerful dynamic. When I am aware of what others don't have, I feel wealthy. But when I'm aware of what I don't have, I feel poor. I've been on trips where I've served on a missions trip in different countries and seen the poorest of the poor. And in those moments, I realize exactly how wealthy I am. And in those moments, you go, man, I can't believe how much I actually have. God has blessed my life. And then I get home from those trips, and a week later, I'm in the mall, and I see something that I didn't even know existed. And in 30 seconds, that's about how long it takes to move from I didn't know that existed to I need one of those in my life. Isn't that amazing? I didn't even know it existed, but what is it? Awareness drives my discontentment. And our culture does a great job of keeping us aware of the stuff that exists and the stuff that we need. You can't even remember all the times that that's happened. And yet, the reality is this: awareness drives our contentment. We weren't discontent until we became aware of the stuff that we didn't have. You're at home and you're just like, man, we have a great house. You know, we're just really thankful. Then you go to a friend's house and their house is, you know, it's bigger and it's newer and it's got modern touches. And you walk back home through your door and you're like, ugh, this place sucks. Sitting in your little hovel, your little, like, living over here in my little cave, like a Neanderthal. What is that? Awareness drives discontentment. And here's another word that's associated with money. The second word is this: greed. Greed. This one's easy to talk about because none of us are greedy, right? Yeah, exactly. I mean, I know there are greedy people in the world, and I'm sure I could point them out to you. I just know that I'm not one of them. And you feel the same way. None of us are greedy because you don't see greedy in the mirror. You see greedy in other people. Well, that person's greedy. Well, they're greedy. But you don't see greedy in the mirror. And so let's look at Jesus' definition of greed for just a minute, and then we'll see where we land. Jesus said, greed is simply the assumption that everything I have is for my consumption. The assumption that if it's in my hand, then it must be for me. That's greed, Jesus says. And we mistakenly believe that greedy people are people who have a lot. Well, those people have more than me, so they're greedy. And those people, they're rich, so they're greedy. And we don't even realize how rich we are. As a matter of fact, you can go to globalrichlist.com this week, plug in your annual salary, and it will tell you exactly how rich you are. Now, I've done it for you. If you make $25,000 a year, $25,000 a year puts you in the top 3% of wealthiest people in the world. That's incredible. If you make $50,000 a year, that's your annual salary, you're in the top 1% of wealthiest people in the world. 50% of the world's population lives on less than $2.50 a day. So here's what that means. If you went and saw a movie this past month, you're rich. And if you bought candy at the theater, then you're filthy rich and irresponsible. Everyone knows you buy it at the gas station or Walmart ahead of time. No, okay. Sorry. If you bought a coffee at a coffee shop this last week, you're rich. You are rich. If you own a car, I don't care if it's a 1970 bright orange AMC Gremlin. You're rich. 84% of the world does not own a car. Think about that. We actually have a house for our car. The house that our car lives in is what most people's houses are made of, where their family lives. Built out of cinder blocks, roughly the same size, that's where most families in the world live. That's where our cars live. We're rich. How about this? How many of you have some coins in the ashtray of your car? That's a rich person problem. When you're like, when you go over a bump and you're like, ugh, my coins are jangling in my ashtray. It's so annoying. That's a rich person problem, okay? If you have different outfits based on the season, if you get frustrated because your closet is so full of summer clothes, and you're like, ugh, I gotta empty out the summer clothes and bring up the winter clothes, so frustrating. I promise you, the rest of the world feels sorry for you. That's a rich person problem, right? If you have access to clean water, you're rich. If you take water that most of the world would drink and you sprinkle it across your grass, you're rich. If you've ever traded in a perfectly working device for another perfectly working device, then you're rich. See, these are rich people problems. And you're rich because you have extra. And see, you didn't even realize how well you were doing until you came here today, did you? You're like, I'm actually doing better than I thought. Top 3%, baby. But that doesn't make you greedy. That doesn't automatically make you greedy. You can have little and be greedy. You can have much and not be greedy. Greed is not about how much or how little you have. Greed is the assumption that it's all for me. Greed is the assumption that whatever I have, however much has been placed in my hands, it's all for my benefit. I'm going to spend it on me. That's greed. In other words, if it gets placed in my hands, then it must be for me. And I may choose to give a little bit of it to you, and I may not. I may choose to be generous, and I may not. But if I do, it's because I'm such a nice person. Because I don't have to give to anyone, because if it gets placed in my hands, it's mine, it belongs to me. If you live with that assumption, if you live with the assumption of consumption, by Jesus' definition, you are a greedy person. Welcome to Westbridge. And if everything that comes to you is for you, if that's the assumption, if you assume that everything that comes to you is for you, then you will spend everything that comes to you on you. And the problem is that greed is an appetite that can never be satisfied. And so no amount of more into your hands will ever make you happy. And the problem in our culture in particular is that we don't have to stop feeding that appetite when the money runs out. Which leads to our third fun word of the day, debt. Debt is when I prefer to owe someone something rather than want something that I can't have. I'd rather owe for it and acquire it than want it and not acquire it. But here's the hard reality that every one of us needs to face and acknowledge. I want is always better than I owe. I want is always better than I owe. When you want something that you don't have, there's a tension there. There's a tension because you have a desire and you want something and you can't have it. When you have something but you owe and you can't pay it, there's a tension there as well. But reality and life experience, and we would all acknowledge if we're honest, that the tension of I want is a much better tension to live with than the tension of I owe. And debt is what happens when we prioritize I owe over I want. And here's the reality. We've all lived long enough to know that. I want is between you and God. It's between you and God. It's dealing with this desire and where is that coming from and this appetite and what do I do with that? That's between you and God. I owe, that's between you and your creditor. And God's on their side. And God's going, look, if you're a follower of Jesus, you need to pay your debts. You have to pay what you owe. And the crazy thing is, the more money that you make, the more tempted you are to go into debt. And it's absolutely pointless because then what you're doing is you're trading your peace for something that can never bring you peace. And then you find yourself unhappy. And money and the desire for more stuff and possessions and acquiring has become your master. You're enslaved to that. You're devoted to that. And you don't want to be. And now your peace is gone and you're unhappy. So let me ask you one more question as it relates to these three words. Discontentment, greed, debt. Discontentment, greed, debt. Which of these words makes you happy? Any of them, you're just like, debt. I love that one. No, here's what we all know intuitively, that none of these words are happy words. None of these words make us feel happy. Discontentment erodes your happiness. Greed and constantly consuming erodes your happiness. Debt erodes your happiness. And we all know this, right? This is pretty much just common sense. None of this stuff ever makes you happy. All of it steals your peace. None of it makes you happy. So here's the practical application. Stop. Just stop. Knock it off. Just don't do this anymore. Right? And if the connection between money and happiness is how you manage it, then to get rid of these three things will make you happy when it comes to your money. How much money would it take to eliminate discontentment from your life? How much money would it take to eliminate greed from your heart? You say, well, there's no amount of money, and here's why. Because these are heart issues, which means they cannot be solved with more. The only way to address discontentment and greed is how you manage what you've been given. It's an issue of the heart. You can't just throw more at it. You have to shift how you view these things. And Jesus says, you cannot be devoted to God and equally devoted and enslaved to money. But there is a way to submit how we manage our money to God and his ways. When you take everything that the Old Testament, the first two-thirds of the Bible and pre-Jesus, and you take everything that was taught in there about money and possessions and finances, and you take everything that Jesus himself taught about money and possessions and finances, and you take everything that the writers after Jesus in the New Testament taught about money and possessions and finances, you can boil it all down to two words: generosity and wisdom. Generosity and wisdom. Generosity and wisdom. These two words. Happy people are generous, and happy people make wise decisions with their money. How to be happy with your money. It all comes down to this. And I'm going to give you all three of the fill in the blanks right off the bat. Here we go. Give, save, live on the rest. I want that phrase to stick in your head. Give, save, live on the rest. Give, save, live on the rest. The first one is this: give. Giving equals joy. Generosity is core to what it means to be a follower of Jesus, because you and I were created in the image of a generous God. We were created in the image of God, and this God is staggeringly generous. As a matter of fact, one of the most popular Bible verses that are most quoted Bible verses is John 3:16. For God so loved the world that he gave. This God that you and I are dealing with is a generous God. In 1 Timothy, Paul is writing to Timothy. He's writing about, essentially about us, about you and I. He's writing about those who have been blessed with extra. And he says this: true godliness with contentment is itself great wealth. Timothy, you want to know what wealth is? It's living your life with contentment. That's great wealth. After all, we brought nothing with us when we came into the world, and we can't take anything with us when we leave it. So if we have enough food and clothing, let us be content. He continues a few verses later, teach those who are rich in this world not to be proud, not to trust in their money, which is so unreliable. And we know that that's true. When money becomes your master, it is a fickle master. Tell them to use their money to do good. They should be rich in good works and generous to those in need, always being ready to share with others. And by doing this, they will be storing up their treasure as a good foundation for the future so that they may experience true life. Paul says, this is true life. When you discover that there's contentment, and when you discover whatever God has placed in my hands, I'm going to be generous. I'm going to share that with others. You are actually investing in eternity, and in doing that, it brings joy. You are investing in eternal life. living a generous life fights against the assumption of consumption. And so if you are a follower of Jesus, now you might be here just, you're checking things out, you're just kind of exploring what you believe or trying to discover where you land with faith, and that's great, and you're kind of dating us, that's awesome. We created this for you to move at your own pace. But if you would say, I'm a follower of Jesus, if you are a follower of Jesus, then I want to challenge you to give regularly and systematically every time that you get paid. Every time that you get paid. Every time that that money comes into your hands. To live open-handed and to live generously is to fight against the assumption of consumption. And is to fight against discontentment and greed. And every time that you get money, you say to your money, you are not my master. I'm going to give some of you away. Every time that you get money, you say, money, God is my boss, and I'm your boss. And so, first you give. Every time that you get, you give. Giving always, always, always results in joy. Discontentment, no joy. But giving, being generous, always results in joy. And so you give first. Every time that you get, you give first. Right off the top, first thing. And then the second thing is this, save. And saving always equals peace. You put some away in your savings. You say, well, I don't know if I can afford to do that. The reality for most of us is this, if we're honest. It's not that we can't afford to save a little. It's that we can't afford to maintain our current lifestyle and save a little. This might require you to sell something, to cancel a subscription, to figure some things out, to manage it differently. But wisdom would suggest that you have something set aside for when you need it. Money in the bank leads to peace of mind. Greed never brings peace. Discontentment never brings peace. Debt never brings peace. And if your happiness is tied to peace, then you give first and you save next. Proverbs 21 says this, the wise have wealth and luxury, but fools spend whatever they get. And that is the truth. If you spend whatever you get, you will not be at peace. Which leads to number three, live on the rest. That means whatever is left after you've given first and set aside some to save, then this now, whatever is left, that becomes your live on budget. The way that you combine generosity and wisdom is to give, save, live on the rest. Give, save, live on the rest. Proverbs 24 says this, do your planning and prepare your fields before building your house. That's wisdom. It says this in Proverbs 27, know the state of your flocks and put your heart into caring for your herds, for riches don't last forever and the crown might not be passed to the next generation. Now, while we may have a lot of sheep herders and people out here caring for flocks, because I know that's a lot of us, what is he saying? He's speaking to understanding your accounts, understanding where you stand financially, because in that day, that was their financial picture. Know the state of your herds and your flocks. For us, know what's in your budget, right? Understand that. And then he says this, because riches don't last forever, the crown might not be passed to the next generation. In other words, our economy isn't always stable. And so he's saying, look, wisdom would suggest that you live within your means, that you live and understand the state of your flocks. And when you go to set your budget, you don't say, oh, what do I want? You say, okay, here's what's coming in. First, I'm giving this, then I'm saving this, and here's what's left. And this now becomes my budget to live on. And when you do that, you experience freedom. Money cannot be your master. You cannot become enslaved to money if you live that way. This is the connection between happiness and money. This is how you make your money make you happy. You cannot serve two masters, and the connection between your money and your happiness isn't more. It's how you manage whatever's been entrusted to you. When I was 10 years old, my dad had just gotten out of jail, and he was one roll away from the yellow properties. We were playing Monopoly. He did not pass go. He did not collect 200. And that meant trouble for him because I owned the yellow properties. And they had hotels on them, and this was my day. Dad wanted to stay in jail longer to avoid paying rent, but he rolled doubles. And so then he got out, and his bacon was about to be fried. And I was sitting at the Monopoly board, and I'm telling you, I had it all that day. 10 years old, I mean, I had money, I had property, I had status and swagger, baby. I'm telling you, it was a great day. I had been a loser at this game my whole life, and today was going to be different. Today was going to be the day that I showed no mercy. And we played this game a lot. I remember getting this game for Christmas one year as a kid. It was a family favorite, sure to elicit shouts of, you know, disappointment and sometimes a board flipping through the air and, my brother. And the glow of victory, right, at the end. And so my dad, I'm going to tell you, he did not play this game like one of those pushover parents who, like, let their kids win to make them feel good, okay? He played to win, all right? And when I got my $1,500 from the bank, I would do the same thing every time. And when I was like, you know, when I was a kid, I would like, oh, $1,500, and I'd save it up. And I wouldn't buy everything because you never know what chance card you're going to get, and the board's a risky place to live, right? And so I would make sure that I would save up my money. I didn't want to spend it. But inevitably, my dad did things differently. He threw caution to the wind. He would purchase every property that he landed on, and then he would mortgage those properties to buy more properties. And inevitably, he would get to the end of the game, and he'd be the master of the board, and he'd own everything. And he understood what I did not, that accumulating is the name of the game, that money is how you keep score, and that, you know, the race goes to the swift. And so eventually he'd become the master of the board and nothing could stop him, and he watched me land on Boardwalk one too many times and hand over my last dollar. And, you know, the game would end, and I put my little top hat back in the box and walk away wondering how I could have lost to him again. Until one day, 10 years old, I figured it out. I finally caught on. It finally dawned on me. The way that you win this game is that you make a total commitment to acquisition, right? No mercy, no fear. And so this time I sat down to play, I was ruthless. This was the time. My palms were sweaty, adrenaline rushing through my veins. I would play without caution. And I was ready to bend the rules if I had to. And slowly and cunningly, I exposed the soft underbelly of his defenses. And relentlessly, I drove him off the board. And I can still remember that moment. It all happened at Marvin Gardens. I looked at my dad, the man who loved me and raised me. And I destroyed him. And I watched him give up his last dollar and quit in utter defeat. It's one of the greatest moments of my life. I had won. I was more clever. I was stronger, handsomer. I was the master of the board. And then came this one phrase that took it all away. Good job, son. Don't forget to put it all back in the box before you go to bed. I mean, all those houses and hotels, all that property, Boardwalk, Park Place, right? The railroads, the utilities. I had it all those thousands of dollars. But when the game is over, it all goes back in the box. I didn't want it to go back in the box. I wanted to leave it out, just leave it sitting on our dining room table as like a perpetual memorial to my skills. Maybe bronze it or something, you know? The time I beat Dad. And I was so heady with victory that I'd lost touch with reality. None of that stuff was really mine. When the game is over, when it's all said and done, it all goes back in the box. And folks, let me tell you something. Life is the exact same way. You can spend your life acquiring and chasing, and you can get more and more and more and more and more. But when the game is over, it all goes back in the box. You don't take any of it with you. The best that you can hope for is not that you get more and more and more and more and more. The best that you can hope to do is to trust God and say, God, help me to manage however much or however little you entrust to me. Because at the end of the game, it all goes back in the box. Imagine what your life would look like if every time that you got money, you gave, you saved, and you lived on the rest. You might have to sell some stuff. You might have to cancel some stuff. But money comes in and you give it to God's kingdom as an eternal investment. And then you save some and then you just live on the rest. Imagine if you lived that way. And if you started sowing in that direction today, imagine what your life would be like a year from now or 5 years or 20 years from now. You would be happy as it relates to your money. And so your best option is to invite your Heavenly Father to manage you as you learn to manage your money. And that's how you keep money from managing you. Giving always leads to joy. And saving always leads to peace. And living on the rest always leads to freedom. So I want to invite you to start today. I want to invite you, regardless of what your life has looked like to this point, I want to invite you to start living this way today. And to sow into your own happiness in the future when it comes to your money.